Good morning, everyone, and thanks for coming this morning. What I'm going to talk about today is a really exciting topic for me, and it's a new topic for me. I have, in the past, done quite a bit of study in old Chan literature, old Zen literature, but I'm not a classical scholar like Dean is. And so one of the things I'm really thrilled about is that he's here today and can help guide me and maybe contribute to the conversation we're having about ancient Greek philosophy, which I am a neophyte at, but I just read a really wonderful book by this scholar named Thomas Machiavelli, who spent a good portion of his life, he was a Greek and Sanskrit scholar, and he spent a very large amount of time, I think I read 20 or 25 years, writing his magnum opus, which was this book that described and really set forth the argument for the influence of Indian Buddhism or Indian philosophy on Greece and the influence of Greek philosophy on India, on both Hinduism and Buddhism. So this was a new subject for me, and I got excited about it. And this came about because I'm going to lead a tour this fall for Tricycle Magazine that goes to China and goes to Dunhuang. Dunhuang is the ancient caves in western China where on the Silk Road, far out in western China, where the caravans would pass and a Buddhist center developed and a lot of Buddhism flowed into China, a great amount. And in the process of researching things about Dunhuang, I decided to go farther back than Dunhuang to see where some of the roots came from. That's what led me to this book that is the basis for much of what I'm going to talk about this morning. So, with that, I'm going to start right off by explaining some of the things that were unique to Greek philosophy that were also unique to Indian philosophy, because the parallels are extremely interesting, and this is one of the main themes of the book. Good morning, come on in. Hi. Just find a place that you can see. I'm just getting started, so you're fine.
And also, by the way, as we're starting here, if there's tea over here, you can help yourself anytime. And I don't know if you want to do a bathroom break in the middle or people.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. So I wonder if I have my phone handy, I can put it. Why don't you give me a signal at about halfway through? Well, there's a clock there, too.
Yeah.
Turn it a little bit, and I'll be. Okay, good. So, based on the work of this scholar, I'm going to offer the first hour today will be particularly involved with some of the things that he talked about and some of the graphs and so on that I've made based on his research, just for my own edification, because this is a new field to me. And then at the second hour, I'm going to talk about how this extends into China. And so I call it Zen Roots and Rebels. And that means that first we'll look at the roots and what developed, and then we'll look at the rebels that rebelled against a bunch of that and why they did it. And those are the Zen masters of ancient China. I start all of my lectures by restating what the founding legend of Zen Buddhism is in China. According to the legend of the origins of Zen, the Buddha lectured at Vulture Peak, and he said, "I have the treasury of the true Dharma eye, the sublime mind of Nirvana, whose true sign is signlessness, the sublime Dharma gate, which without words or phrases is transmitted outside of the standard teachings or the teachings. and which I bestow upon Mahakashyapa. Normally, when I offer this at the beginning of my slideshows, I emphasize the word signlessness, because signlessness is such a pervasive concept in Zen Chinese literature. It's not a coincidence that it's used so as the primary sublime Dharma gate of the introduction of the legend origins of Zen. But today, I'm not going to emphasize that particular point as much as I'm going to talk about is transmitted outside of the teachings. That will be a key part of what transpires today. And the signlessness idea, by the way, just some people are actually new to signlessness. They've never heard of it in Zen. But if you go back in Zen history and examine it carefully, for example, these are all ancient Zen paintings from about 800 or 600 years ago of the most famous Zen painters in history. And they depict the traditional scene of Shakyamuni descending the mountain after his enlightenment, after he decides to teach. The unique feature of that is that while you normally see Buddhas in the pose of a mudra, in all Zen traditional paintings, the hands are covered. They're not revealed. So this is one of the ways that ancient Zen always conveyed the fundamental teaching of signlessness. The nature of consciousness is signless. And so this is a common aspect of ancient Zen literature and art. Yes?
Why are the hands, the cover, why is the covering of the hands?
Because a mudra is a sign.
Oh.
And the covering of the hands indicates that this is a signless teaching. So I'm going to start right off with some parallels between ancient Buddhist philosophy and things that people in Zen would be familiar with. Heraclitus, who lived around 500 BC, said, "Fullness and emptiness are the same thing. God is fullness / emptiness." So that has a hint of the Heart Sutra, doesn't it? He said, "To be wise is one thing, to understand the intention which drives all things through all things." So that kind of has a hint of the Avatamsaka Sutra, I believe. And the wise, that's a typo, excuse me, the wise are non-abiding. And there are various sutras that expound that idea, including the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor. So those are, and there's many more actually parallels like that in his book. And if you know about, read about Chinese philosophy and so on, you're struck by the parallels between certain concepts in Greek philosophy, like the idea of non-action. That's a very big concept in Chinese metaphysics. Over the throne room in the Forbidden City in China, in the Forbidden City where the emperors would sit, the sign would say non-action. The emperor in his perfect virtue had to do nothing to teach us all what to do, supposedly. Same thing in Greek philosophy. They had the same idea. Are they connected? I don't know. But one thing that is quite striking is the doctrine of reincarnation. And in both Greece and India, there was what the scholar Machiavelli describes as a tripartite doctrine of reincarnation in both places. And I'll make 2 points. First of all, I guess I should say there were three terms connected with each idea, and there was a corresponding term in the other philosophy. So in India, you had samsara, the wheel of birth and death, and karma, which was the resolution of action, the result of the act of action, and action itself was karma, and moksha, which is liberation. We're seeing through it. In Greece, these are the three terms that he lists that correspond directly to that in the Greek concept of reincarnation. Now, I say the Greek concept of reincarnation. Who believed this in ancient Greece? Turns out a whole bunch of people did that you've heard of. Pythagoras, Plato, Democritus, and many others, names that are very common, not only believe this, they were fervent believers, especially Pythagoras. Apparently, Pythagoras, who we know because of the sum of the square of the other two sides equals the square of the hypotenuse or whatever. He deeply believed in reincarnation like this. And the story is that when he was finally, and he also, they were strict vegetarians. They believed that because the karma works itself out, you gain a higher rebirth based on your ethical action. And they were strict vegetarians. And the story is that, one story is that Pythagoras was caught and killed by soldiers who apparently the establishment didn't like him back then. When they cornered him and he refused to run across this field of sprouts that were growing. He wouldn't even run across the field of sprouts and disrupt life in that fashion. So he was almost like a Jain, right? It's just Jainist philosophy, which also existed in India very powerfully at this time. So the parallels, what the scholar points out is that Western scholars, and I think partly because of the Christian interpretation of Aristotle and the development of that sort of thing, led to a real downplaying of this mystical side, what they regarded as a mystical side of Greek philosophy, but it was actually very prominent. So that's the argument set forth in this book, at least. So he postulates various ways that the two places could have exchanged this philosophy. A figure named, is that Pherecydes? Anyway, Pherecydes may have introduced reincarnation to Greece around 600 BC. He was said to have been the teacher of Pythagoras in some accounts. But there were other schools that clearly believed in this. The Eleatic school of philosophy in Greece, where it was very, which was a very early school, pre-Socratic, that also was committed to this idea. So yes, as I mentioned, Pythagoras was a deep believer in reincarnation, and he was said to have been able to see his past lives. And Pherecydes and others were also credited with being able to see their previous lives. The Orphics were the group I just mentioned, and they specifically said that they believed, besides believing in reincarnation, they expounded that a virtuous life would allow release from the sorrowful, weary wheel. And Empedocles is famous as an expounder of this, and including vegetarian. He said, "Do you not see that you are devouring each other in the thoughtlessness of your minds? The father in his folly lifts up his son and slaughters him. Son takes father, children their mother." So it's a very Hindu kind of idea, right? We often hear the Hindu idea of reincarnation, dying. Don't harm, don't squash that bug that was your mother, you know. So it's the same kind of thing.
And that was a lot of that was before the Buddha lived.
About the same time. Yeah. And Plato said this leads to the character. He emphasized the moral nature of rebirth. Plato said that, you know, the character that is becoming better to a better incarnation, it leads to, you know, all the karma and all that leads to a person that is becoming better to a better incarnation, and that is what is just growing worse to a worse incarnation, each according to his due. And those who have cultivated gluttony and selfishness are likely to assume the form of donkeys and other perverse animals. Well, those who have preferred a life of lawlessness and violence become wolves and hawks and kites. And it occurred to me, I didn't put the word kites in there, but it occurs to me that in Buddhism, I realized afterwards that there's something about being reborn as hawks and kites, I've read somewhere. But of course, Rinzai, for example, this was one example, warned against actions that would lead you being reborn in the womb of an ass. So I was quite struck by these arguments that were being put forth, and in reading the book, he posits that while early on it appears there was interchange, doctrines like reincarnation and similar things that we associate with India were definitely in Greece, and then he discusses various possibilities, like it came from India to Greece, or it came from Persia and went to both places, or different possibilities of how these ideas might have diffused where they might have originated, might have diffused. And Egypt is brought into the picture and different aspects of it. And that's rather speculative, but at least he advances some arguments of how these striking parallels, the only two places in ancient life, in fact, anywhere, that this tripartite concept of reincarnation existed, were in these two places at about the same time. Although India seems to have preceded Greece.
So there weren't any other... Has someone researched to see that there weren't any other places where this was happening?
He has. He did. He was a scholar, He was quite an amazing man. I want to find out more about him. Besides being a Sanskrit and Greek scholar who could read both of them and was thoroughly read in both philosophies, he was recognized as an art critic. All types of art, apparently, but particularly ancient art. And he was a recognized postmodernist in terms of his viewpoint. Yes?
In relation to that, does he discuss the exchange of material goods in those days across the trade routes? That would be a wonderful form of support to the...
He does that specifically to the extent that we have evidence of it. He talks about the trade routes for the ships sailing from Egypt, Suez, going to the coast of India during various periods, what they were carrying, what we know about it, and that sort of thing. So the striking thing is that, let me show you the next slide and come back to this one. This is called the Maurya dynasty in 265 BC, and this was what is called the first great Greek dynasty that covered all of India. And so the first question most people have, like I had, was, wow, I didn't know that Greece dominated all of India or that there was a Greek dynasty covering all of India. And then I started studying about it, and I found that, as he explains in the book, Alexander the Great marched from Greece to conquer northwest India in around 340 BC. And subsequent to that, I put this chart together myself because I was trying to get a picture of what happened. And subsequent to that, so Alexander the Great comes. And then the empire I just mentioned, the Maurya Empire, occurred. And it was dominated by kings who were deeply imbued with Greek culture. And to the extent that they were adopted Buddhism and embraced it very thoroughly. They were a Greek culture. They adopted and embraced Buddhism, but they were Greeks. And that's why the early statues of Buddha appear as Greeks. And then all of these subsequent kingdoms, the Mauryan Empire, the Greco-Bactrian Empire, the Indo-Greek Kingdom, the Parthian Empire, and the Kushan Empire, that all dominated either northwest India or India itself, were Greek, deeply embedded Greek philosophy and so on. And it turns out Alexander the Great brought philosophers with him, he brought bureaucrats, he set up polises, the Greek cities. I forget the exact number, around nine major cities in northern India and around that area that were even named Alexandria, you know, after him. And so when you consider that this went on to around, and the last Indo-Greek kingdom, which was specifically Greek in terms of having Greeks running it, its kings, extends to the year 10 AD. So for a period of several hundred years, Greeks actually dominated that zone. And this, by the way, this gives an idea of where different people lived along that timeline. Here's the Greek philosophers, Socrates, and then, you know, his student Plato, and Plato's student Aristotle. And Aristotle was the teacher of Alexander the Great. And Alexander the Great then, you know, influenced by philosophy, He studied under Aristotle, but I don't know if he really was an Aristotelian in terms of his outlook, but there, he certainly knew a lot of different philosophy, because Aristotle was, of course, familiar with all the great philosophical tradition. And I presume Alexander got that as part of his training. But you've got Ashoka the Great, who was the third Mauryan emperor, was Ashoka. And when you look at the places where there are, you know, we know of Ashoka primarily through the columns that he built that were inscribed with records of his rule. And either some of the columns or certain columns had both languages, some of the columns were written in very high level Greek, according to my understanding. Not some washed downism, but high literary Greek, indicating the high level of Greek influence that was being exerted. And one other point that I think I'll make in passing is that Machiavelli emphasizes that the Greek conquests did not appear to be racist. They readily married into the local populations and didn't establish the Greeks as a ruling class over the other people. And you could probably comment on that better than me, but the striking feature is that it had none of the later colonial aspects of white man's burden sort of thing. So that was all quite shocking to me when I read all this and looked at it. So the Maurya dynasty was established by Chandragupta. The third emperor was Ashoka. Let's go one more second. I'm just going to point out that Nagarjuna was about right here. I might have a slide that shows that later. He's on this side. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm thinking of got it wrong. But there's some certain other key figures. Nagarjuna was right here, and that was the arising of the Prajnaparamita. And that'll come into the situation as we talk about it. So Ashoka's empire extended very far, the Mauryan Empire. He talks in the historical records indicate that he sent envoys that were Greeks and were Buddhists, I think, actual Buddhist envoys that went as far as Shramanas, holy men, that went as far as Greece. And there's some records in Greece of those holy men coming to visit from him. And so this, anyway, is the depiction of how his influence spread as a Greek-influenced monarch. Yeah?
Does he, as far as you remember, talk about any particular influences that these Greeks returning from India with the Buddhist philosophy had on the sort of post-Socratic philosophy? I'm thinking of Epicureanism, which seems to me to be the most likely candidate among the later Greek philosophies that seems to have a lot of relevance.
He does. It's quite possible. I mean, this is an area that I think he covered massively, but there's a massive amount of more work to be done and more parallels to be drawn. He draws some very striking parallels in the book, but as you know better than I, Greek philosophy is a vast subject. There are lots of schools, and they were influenced in various and complex ways. And he draws out certain inferences from all that, which I'll talk about. But I think there's a lot more that could probably be examined, and you're probably bringing one up. And he does mention the Epicureans a few times, but it was such a complex argument, I couldn't follow all the lines of it very well.
Okay.
Yes?
So, as I understand, he's translating Aryan as Greek, right?
Because translating what?
Aryan, you know? The Aryan caste, the class of Greek people that in other history books are being described to have governed north, and you're saying they're Greek. So I'm just wanting to point out that they're different translations of the same.
I don't think so. My impression is that the normal Aryan philosophy predated the Greeks. In other words, the Aryans were previous to that. And my impression is that there's a lot of controversy around the Aryan idea.
Yeah.
Because is it Persian? Were they certain tribes in Persia? And how did they really influence things? And I think part of the 19th century racist, you know, interpretation of history took up this idea of Arianism and magnified it out of proportion, possibly. Certainly got magnified out of proportion in Germany. So I don't think the Arians play into this picture. He talks about them in the book, but it doesn't look to me like that was a real central role in all this.
Yeah, because it can't, like, you were just talking about the time period of like 500 years, and you were keep saying these are Greek influence, and I kind of can't see, if they don't have a dominant role and they're married into the culture, they're not Greek anymore, then they are part of the culture. I mean, it's, I'm not quite, I don't see the clear distinction of saying they are Greek. The Greek influence, I wouldn't call them Greek though, over 500 years, if it didn't dominate.
Well, the way that the book argues it is, they kept their culture. The Greek culture was retained and fused with what happened locally. And I'll get to that in a minute, a little bit more about that. A key concept, now we're getting into the rebel part, starts to rear its head, because a key concept in this that was adopted by the Mauryan Empire very early was they accepted Buddhism. Now imagine the Greeks coming and intermingling with the local population, but much of the local population is in a nascent or developed culture of Hinduism. And it wasn't the full-blown Hinduism we might think of today, but it was a caste system, and it had a lot of features that we associate with Hinduism. And so the Greeks then found Buddha, found him to be brilliant, embraced his philosophy, and could use it as an ideology to rule. Now, they were part of the ruling class, but they weren't racistly part of a ruling class. They intermarried the nobles from the Greeks would bring the nobles from the locals, and they would form alliances and so on. But there was still clearly a ruling class. And how do you, if you're a Greek, absorbing and ruling, how do you become part of the local? Well, Buddhism was a religion which got rid of the caste system. And this would be very attractive because the Greeks were not part of the caste system. And in order to assimilate, Buddhism would be an ideal philosophy. Plus, they clearly believed in Buddhism. So it took on a political element, possibly. I think, yes.
Something that I'm speculating might add to that is that one of the ways for Greeks to understand who they were in terms of their identity was which god in their pantheon was their chief one that you celebrated on this day or that day. And I can imagine them going to these places and saying, but we still worship Athena. We're still Athenians. To be an Athenian, and not only to live in that city, but to have that relationship to Athena. If you would go into a place where there was a lot of Hindu culture, you'd say, oh, look, they're all worshiping tons of other gods, too. We've got ours. And so you could kind of keep a lot of your Greek identity by virtue of continuing to worship toward those gods. But the Buddha represents already familiar figure in this Greek way of thinking about philosophy, which is the philosopher who contemplates and who can also be pious toward the gods of the city, but has a special and distinctive role of contemplation. So I can see a lot of, now that you're mapping these onto each other, these are some of the resonances.
Yeah, it opens up all kinds of possibilities, I think, when you start considering what the process that must have happened. But the Chakravartin, the reason I have this up here is simply because that was the Buddhist monarch. And the emperor or the king who had embraced Buddha, embraced Buddhism, and ruled as Buddhism as his political ideology was called the Chakravartin. There was a term for it. And the Mauryan emperors were declared to be Chakravartin kings, kings who turned the wheel of Dharma. This is actually a king turning the wheel of Dharma. So they would, and the idea of turning of a chakra, the turning the wheel of the Dharma, was actually associated with the idea of the wheel of the chariot of the king extending throughout the empire. The wheel of the chariot of the Chakravartin king could go all the places that I was pointing with those arrows. And so the turning the wheel of the Dharma had the wheel, the idea of the teaching and also the emperor who could project the power of the Buddhist state. So the idea of a Chakravartin king became a dominant form of the political ideology of Buddhism. Now I should say that what I regard as what I'm trying to make my contribution to the dialogue about all this is to emphasize the two streams of Buddhism that existed from these times forward, which was imperial Buddhism, the doctrines of the state, and what I would call Zen, which is leaving the world, like in the traditional mendicant monk, and going off and, you know, not getting involved with all that stuff, which is, you know. So I propose to you that when you look at these two lines of Buddhism throughout history, you realize that certain things that happened and certain ideas were part of one group that was pushing it, and other things that were happening were coming from the other group, and there was always a tension. And I have many, 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 many examples of how that happened and how it worked, that dynamic. And when you stop and think about it, is that so surprising? It's been happening in every other religion we've ever seen. You know, the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church becomes dominant and a political force, and then the Lutherans happen, and Henry VIII happens. I mean, is this a new story? No. And I'm just pointing out that if you look, you notice the same thing was happening in Buddhism. So the first references to a Chakravartin appear in the monuments of the Mauryan Empire, dedicated to Chakragupta, Maurya, and his grandson Ashoka. Now, he proposes that it has not generally been used for any other historic figure. I copied this right out of his book. But I didn't believe that that was true when I said it, because I know that Emperor Wu declared himself to be a Chakravartin king. Emperor Wu, who met Bodhidharma. And I thought, well, maybe he just didn't know about the Chinese. And then I went over the list and I realized there were several Chinese emperors that declared themselves Chakravartin kings. Now, just as an example of a doctrine that you could have that would come from a Chakravartin king as opposed to, you know, an authentic mendicant home-leaving, signless teaching of the Zen world would be, I mean, having 32 marks is, well, from the sutra. What do you think, Subhuti? Is the Tathagata to be seen by means of his possession of marks? Does the Tathagata have marks? Well, that's an established, even in Zen literature, you read where they're talking about the marks of a Buddha. But this doctrine says, no, indeed, O Lord, the Lord said, if Subhuti, the Tathagata, could be recognized by his possession of marks, then also the universal monarch would be a Tathagata. So this is an argument against the idea of the marks of a Buddha. So this implies it's implied criticism that there's Chakravartin kings out there saying that they have the marks of a Buddha. But that's not really a Buddha. They're just saying that because they're trying to make themselves out to be exalted spiritual beings to lead the church. Yes?
Could we equate marks with signs?
Signs, yeah. A mark is a sign.
So signlessness.
So this is signlessness again, exactly. Yeah.
In this case, referring to things like long earlobes.
Yeah. Well, they had a lot of different marks.
But physical.
Physical attributes, yeah.
And it's a Diamond Sutra?
This is Diamond Sutra, I believe, yeah. So, once again, I just keep bringing this back to emphasize the graphic nature of how this developed. All of these empires which ruled in that area were deeply Greek, and starting with the Mauryan Empire, they embraced Buddhism, and Buddhism became a political, Chakravartin dominant political ideology. It's a king.
It's a
Chakravartin literally means, I think, the wheel-turning king. Chakra is the spokes of a wheel, I think. And so it's the king who turns the spokes of the wheel, something like that. And it's still, by the way, the political symbol of modern India. The wheel with this, I think you see it in the flag. In the money, yeah.
Can we add Buddhist to that definition of Chakravartin? Can we say Buddhist wheel-turning king, or would that be going?
You know, I don't know whether It was originally defined as the Buddha, but I think the Indians might have adopted it into the rest of their culture. They know originally came from Ashoka, I think. But now they use it for, as a symbol. And everyone in India, I think, is really cognizant of Ashoka the Great. Whether they're Buddhist or not, they know that he was a great forebear of Indian civilization. So all these other kingdoms, like the Indo-Greek kingdom, spread around and moved around, and there were several different ones, and they had, here's Alexandria on the Indus, Alexandria in the Caucasus, Alexandria in Arachosia. So, you know, these city-states were set up the way that classical Greek city-states were in Greece, which is laid out in rectangular grid. They were set up as a huge rectangular grid. Now, all my life, from the time I studied Asian studies, I've thought about the fact that ancient Chang'an, ancient Xi'an in China, the great capital of China, was laid out in this grid. And then the Japanese went to Chang'an over in ancient times and got the same idea, came back and built Kyoto the same way. Kyoto in Japan has built the same great rectangular grid. Now I'm thinking about this. I mean, if they had this stuff going back between them and these city-states over the Silk Road, maybe that whole grid thing came from Greece and ended up in Kyoto. I don't know. But it's all starting to... I'm starting to question everything I've ever thought I've known now. Yes.
So did Buddhist philosophy go back to Greece? You know, you could kind of draw in the one-way, arrow.
Well, the question might be, did it ever leave, or when did it leave? But it didn't go back. I think in the sense that we don't see a recognized Buddhist church in Greece, but what we do see are certain lines of Greek philosophy that are the same as what happened in Mahayana Buddhism, and I'll get to that. So Demetrius founded the Indo-Greek kingdom. So here's the Indo-Greek kingdom. Notice that it's about 200 BC to just about zero, a little past there. And here's a coin of Demetrius, and he wears the helmet that was worn by Alexander the Great, the elephant helmet. So they were clearly Greek in outlook, the Indo-Greeks. Now, let's see. Menander the First, who was here, part of the Indo-Greek kingdom, is very well known in the Buddhist world because that's King Milinda. King Milinda is famous. I'm not going to go into all the details, but King Milinda is famous for a famous dialogue he had with a Buddhist monk named Nagasena. And Nagasena, first of all, Milinda was a Greek, and it appears that Nagasena and other monks of the time were also Greeks. Most of the details on this slide are not relevant right now. I'm just going to explain some of the things that happened. But he was well known in Greece at the time. Apollodorus of Artemida, as quoted by Strabo, claimed that Greeks from Bactria, in other words, in this kingdom, were even greater conquerors than Alexander the Great, and that Menander was one of the two Bactrian kings with Demetrius, who extended their power farthest into India. Now, his fame comes from a dialogue with the monk Nagasena in the Pali Canon, and picture him talking with a Buddhist monk and an audience there. This is the scene. The king is asking the monk questions about Buddhism. And Nagasena is lecturing him on the false nature of impugned reality. And specifically, he's talking about the symbol of the emperor, the chariot. And Augustine is telling him there's no such thing as a chariot. What is a chariot? Is it the spokes? Is it the axle? Is it, what is it? And he says, there's no such thing as a chariot. You are king over all of India, a mighty monarch. Of whom then are you afraid that you speak untruth? And he called upon the Yoknakas, the people in the audience and brethren to witness, saying, Melinda, the king here has said that he came here by carriage. And he asked, in that case, explain what a carriage is. And he was unable to do so. And is he pot? I'm sorry for the typos in this. Is it pot? Why? How do you say what the chariot is? Is it, what part of the chariot comprises chariot? Or is it just a mental idea you have of this composite, this aggregate of things? Anyway, this is the conversation going on. And the 500 Yoknakas in the audience. Now, this is the striking part. I read this when I was maybe 19, when I first read the dialogue of King Melinda. And I went back and started rereading it after I read his book. And this is what struck me first. When he had thus spoken, the 500 Yoknakas shouted their applause and said to the king, now I'll let your majesty get out of that one if you can. So the people in the audience were actually saying to a king, this is the Orient, Oriental despotism and all that. Hey, king, yeah, I try to get out of that one. Ha, ha, ha. You bet you can't answer that question. Ha, ha. That's impossible. You don't read anything like that in other Asian literature. Nobody talks to a king like that. Why were they doing that? Because these people were Greeks. Yoknaka is the word that comes from Ionian. The people in the audience were actually Greeks, and that's what Yoknakas means. And they had a dialectical form of argument that they had brought with them from Greece that they were talking about in the Indo-Greek Empire with King Melinda, with this monk who was probably also a Greek. And they were having a Greek debate. This is something right out of the Parthenon or the Acropolis. I had no idea what this was about until I read this book that explained it. And then it got worse, because not only were all the people in the audience that were Greeks yelling at the king and having this Greek debate, but, you know, King Melinda, who was ultimately declared to be an arhat, embraced Buddhism, became an arhat, and all the great Greek missionaries that he sent out, and they went all over the country converting people, they were mostly Greeks. Now, one key point is that Nagasena, Naga, which means dragon, I don't know what Sena means, but Nagasena is reputed to have been, in some sources, as the teacher of Nagarjuna. That would make sense. They both have the same name. That's the tradition that came down in China. You take your teacher's name, Dharma name. And Nagarjuna, of course, wrote the exposition on the Middle Way, which formed the basis of the Prajnaparamita scriptures that went into East Asia. And we'll get to that. Another monk who was Madhya Dharma Raksita, which literally means the great protector of the Dharma, was a Greek Buddhist master who lived the 2nd century during the reign of the Indo-Greek king Menander. And a key Pali text records him as having traveled from Alexandria of the Caucasus, to Kabul with 30,000 monks for the dedication of ceremony of the Mahatupa, the great stupa, at Anuradhapura in Sri Lanka, when it was completed upon the death. The point is, from Alexandria, the city of the Yonas, came the Thera elder Yona, Madhyamaka, whatever, with 30,000 bhikshus. These people were Greeks. Greek was a fundamental aspect of what was going on in the spread of Mahayana Buddhism at this time. It wasn't a sideshow. It wasn't something else that was in the culture. It was a Greek thing.
I don't quite get the step from a town being name to say that all the people are Greeks?
All the people weren't Greeks. The Greeks were a dominant class of the population. A major, and much of the civilization was Greek. Much of the culture was Greek. And the Buddhist religion in particular was dominated by Greeks. It's what the evidence suggests.
Racially, like Greek origin?
Not racially so much as culturally.
There was a
great deal of intermarriage. There were, I'll show you what I mean by there was a great deal of intermarriage, and it was both cultures together in a bit here. But so there's the Indo-Greek kingdoms specifically in 100 BC. Some of them, as he shows it. So now we come to the art part of it. The Greeks, of course, as Dean's already explained, had their own gods, and they would represent them. We all know the Greek gods in the Acropolis, and we've seen them in museums and all that. Well, here they are. They started making statues of Buddha, Gandharan Buddhas. This is a Gandhara Buddha. And his guardian deity appears to be Heracles. Hercules is what the Romans called him. The first guardian deity that I've seen, you know, these early statues were actually Greek gods. And furthermore, the hairdo of Buddha is the hairdo associated with Apollo. Apollo had a little knot on his head like that. And the Greeks associated Buddha apparently with Apollo in terms of his representation. I don't have an explanation for that exactly, but yes.
Is there an approximate date or century for this artwork?
That's a key part of this argument. Because most, and this, remember the fellow writing this book was an art historian. Mm-hmm. Most scholars have said that the Greek Gandharan art probably occurred around 100 AD. And it's hard to get into all the reasons they said that, but one of the reasons that he argues in the book is that in the post-World War II period, the Indian anti-colonial movement and scholars were very resentful that Greece may have dominated or culturally dominated India. And scholars tiptoed around the idea that they came earlier than that. Because if they're later, it means it was just some Greek influence that influenced Indian philosophy. If it came earlier, it could have meant that the Greeks really dominated the culture very heavily and contributed to what happened in India. So there are a lot of complex reasons that a postmodernist argues why people would say that. Postmodernism, by the way, is the idea that, roughly speaking, correct me if I'm wrong, as I understand it, it's the idea that you can't just say that there's one perspective that's right about how history developed. The whole idea of saying that is kind of a colonial mentality. Everybody is very much influenced by their own circumstances. So a postmodernist tends to analyze things in terms of how things were in that time and whose ideas were dominant, rather than saying there's just one interpretation of how history developed. Like, a postmodernist would recognize that the British wrote history a certain way, and it was racist against the Indians. And so a modernist might say, well, you know, everybody's got their own thing, right? So you have to tiptoe around the minefield of nationalism and things like that. He was regarded as a postmodernist because he tended to say, well, you know, it's true that first of all, India apparently sent reincarnation to Greece, so it's not like it was a one-way street. And they weren't racist when they conquered. They tended to intermarry. But it looks to me like Greek culture really dominated this area at that time. And here are the reasons. So to answer your question now, he moves the date back from 100 AD to 100 BC when the Gandharan statues were probably actually created. But previously, most of the arguments have been said they were later. Long story short. Let's see. This just says what I just told you. The great Hellenistic works may actually be wrongly attributed to later centuries and instead belong to a period one or two centuries earlier, to the time of the Indo-Greeks, which would make sense, right? I mean, if you're carving Greek statues, you're probably Greek, pretty heavy Greek influence. So he moves it from there back to here, roughly speaking. When you look at the Gandharan art, I mean, that's, you know, rather Greek-looking, the early statues of Buddha. And Maitreya appears about this time, Maitreya Buddha. And if you read old Buddhism, you might wonder, well, where did they come up with Maitreya? You know, why do you have suddenly a millenarian Buddha appear on the screen, like a god? I mean, wasn't Buddha a man? How did this god appear? And how come he's going to come in the future and save everybody? This becomes an intriguing question that I propose that you need to analyze in terms of these two streams of Buddhism I was talking about. Because Maitreya actually serves a terrific political purpose, which I'll talk about. But even, this is 3rd century, so this is like way after the Greek kingdoms had died out, but in the same era. I mean, maybe it's actually earlier than 3rd century, but that's what most people have attributed it. And it's a Buddhist myth story where they're clearly depicted like Greeks. Now, I just mentioned Maitreya, and this is where my scholarship starts to pick up, because it starts getting involved with concepts that I've been arguing about in Chinese history. This is the Parinirvana of the Buddha when he died. And you can clearly see that this was a mixed race event according to this depiction of it. Of course, there were no Greeks there when Buddha died, I don't think. But the way that this is depicted shows Greeks and Indian sorts of people mourning the death of the Buddha, Parinirvana. The reason I particularly show this slide as a piece of Gandharan Greek art is because one of the primary vehicles for the exposition, in my opinion, of Imperial Buddhism was the Mahaparinirvana Sutra. It introduced certain ideas that seemed to really go against what had been going on prior to that in Buddhism. And I'll explain that a little more, but just two points, the Maitreya and that. And so, but then you get into this whole range of art where the Buddha is depicted in that way. I've taken some of them out to shorten the program. But, and then depictions spread out also in Hinduism, and the Greek influence of creating icons became widespread in Asia. Prior to that, neither Buddhism nor Hinduism displayed iconic figures. The power of the image to rule, to dominate people, to rule, the image is powerful. The Greeks knew that better than anybody, I think, probably. And the Romans took it on too. The appearance of the Prajnaparamita concepts of emptiness is intimately tied with this political-religious nexus. The rejection of any possible foundational reality, as advanced by Nagarjuna, closely parallels developments in the Greco-Roman philosophy during the time of Nagarjuna. And the early propounder of the philosophy that was used by Nagarjuna, the Machiavelli traces the dialectical argument that Nagarjuna uses in Greek history. And he finds that that particular dialectical argument, which was common to certain schools, was particularly common to Pyrrhonism, as it ultimately evolved and matured over a very long period of time. Not this, not that, you know. Not this, not this, not that, not that, however it goes. So, Pyrrhon was a very early Greek philosopher who developed this very, you know, attacked everything as having no substantiality. And later, his philosophy was taken up by a Roman philosopher, Sextus Empiricus, who was very, very dominant and very well known at the time just when Nagarjuna lived. And his philosophy, his books, his writings, quite likely were part of the Greco-Indian Empire at that time. It spread through that time. Let me show you the timeline that you can see clearly, because it's actually here. Sextus Empiricus was a Roman who expounded Pyrrhonism, and here's Nagarjuna. He was just prior to that. But the influence, and this was in the Kushan Empire, which was again a Greek, highly Greek influenced empire. So Machiavelli argues that this kind of argument didn't drop out of the sky. It took the Greeks a long time, several hundred years, to develop it, this type of dialectical argument that was possibly first shown in King Melinda and his dialectical arguments. And that dialectical argument, which had become pervasive through this fellow, Sextus Empiricus, then appeared in the writings of Nagarjuna and gave rise to the Prajnaparamita literature. And he also talks about certain metaphors that were used both in Greece and then appeared in the literature, like a snake and a rope. It was a phrase used by Nagarjuna's student, Aryadeva. And then that phrase, which appears in Indian philosophy, thereafter appears in Prajnaparamita literature and even in Zen. It was a metaphor that was used by Sextus Empiricus, who I just mentioned, the Roman, and then Zen master Shirgwe said, once bitten by a snake and thereafter afraid of a broken rope in a well. Just to show how the same metaphor seems to have appeared in Zen after that.